You are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to ifhpodcastnetwork.com.
Welcome to the Indie Film Hustle Podcast, episode number 490. Cinematography, a military art. Prepare a film like a battle. Robert Benson.
Broadcasting from the back alley in Hollywood, it's the Indie Film Hustle Podcast, where we show you how to survive and thrive as an indie filmmaker in the jungles of the film biz. And here's your host, Alex Ferrari.
Welcome, welcome to another episode of the Indie Film Hustle Podcast. I am your humble host, Alex Ferrari. Today's show is sponsored by Indie Film Hustle's Filmmaker Process. We provide filmmakers with professional services to get their films or series funded, finished, and distributed. Some of the services we offer are pitch deck creation, film budgets and schedules, domestic and international sales estimates, legal contract templates, consulting, post-production services, script coverage, professional trailer editing, poster design, film deliverables, and production payroll. To learn more, go to www.filmmakerprocess.com. Today's show is sponsored by Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, how to turn your independent film into a profitable business. It's harder today than ever before for independent filmmakers to make money with their films. From predatory film distributors ripping them off to huckster film aggregators who prey upon them, the odds are stacked against the indie filmmaker. The old distribution model of making money with your film is broken, and there needs to be a change. The future of independent filmmaking is the entrepreneurial filmmaker or the filmtrepreneur. In Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, I break down how to actually make money with your film projects and show you how to turn your indie film into a profitable business. With case studies examining successes and failures, this book shows you the step-by-step method to turn your passion into a profitable career. If you're making a feature film, series, or any other kind of video content, the Filmtrepreneur method will set you up for success. The book is available in paperback, ebook, and of course, audiobook. If you want to order it, just head over to www.filmbizbook.com. That's filmbizbook.com. Now, guys, today on the show, we're going to talk about the art of light, cinematography, and specifically how directors need to approach working with cinematographers about what they should know, kind of basic baseline information that most directors need to know in order to work comfortably with a cinematographer to get their vision onto the screen and so on. And we have today on the show Jacqueline B. Frost, who is the author of Cinematography for Directors, a guide on how to work with a cinematographer. And we go deep in the weeds on cinematography and how you are supposed to work with your cinematographer, the do's and the do nots, things to watch out for, pitfalls that directors often fall into, and so on. So without any further ado, please enjoy my conversation with Jacqueline B. Frost. I'd like to welcome to the show Jackie Frost. How are you doing, Jackie?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm very good. Thank you so much for being on the show. We're going to talk about today. I wanted to have you on the show because of your book, Cinematography for Directors. And as I was saying to you before we started recording, I've been a cinematographer, which I do not consider myself a cinematographer, but I have lit a feature film. So arguably I've made it. I sold it. So apparently I did something okay. There was an image. It looked clean. All that kind of good stuff. And I've been a director for most of my career. So I've worked with good cinematographers, I've worked with bad cinematographers. And I really think that a lot of, especially young up and coming directors, don't understand the relationship, don't understand the nuance of that relationship, how important it is, how to collaborate, all these kind of things. But we're going to get into the weeds about all of this. But before we get started, how did you get started in the business?
Well, it goes back quite a ways right now, but I mean, when I was an undergrad studying, photography, fine arts, I was really into, you know, art history. I was into photography, and then I took a film history course, and that just opened up a whole other chapter of my life. Mm-hmm. My professor actually said, "You're really good at this and you have a knack for it." I said, "Okay." So I pursued studies in film production after that. And because I already had a background in photography, when I did get to grad school, I could shoot better than most of the people there. So suddenly I'm shooting like everybody's film. So I realized I really liked the creation of the image. cut to 30 years later, I still love the creation of the image. I realized that cinematography is an endless learning process because I, of course, learned in 16 millimeter film, black and white reversal. Then I went to color reversal. I was so excited. When I finally got to color negative, I thought I'd hit the big time, you know, and going from 16 to super 16 to 35 is like, wow, you know. But then everything changed, of course. So I've also been an educator in the field of cinematography and film production and documentary production and you name it, as some studies courses as well for a good portion of my career. So I shoot, I teach, and basically my background from the fine arts and photography and cinematography all merged into something that was highly relatable to many other cinematographers. And something that it seemed filled a void between the director and the cinematographer. So that in a nutshell, that's 30 years or so.
So in a nutshell, I got you. So yeah, that's, and again, that relationship is so important, especially when you're, because like I said, I've worked with good DPs. I've worked with horrible DPs. Isn't it true that all you need to be a DP is you just need to buy a camera, right? That's just the way it works, right? If you buy a red camera, you're automatically a cinematographer. Isn't that the way it works?
Oh, yeah, sure.
That was my biggest frustration coming up because, you know, you would, when I didn't know any better, you'd hire people because of their gear and not because of their talent. And that is one of the biggest mistakes as a director. Well, they have a grip truck and they've got a Red or they got an Alexa, that they must know what they're doing. No. What's your experience?
It's not necessarily the case. And, you know, obviously, not all cinematographers, and I learned this a long way too, own their own gear because, you know, it's what they do with the gear, not having the stuff. Well, I got a whole bunch of stuff. I don't know how to use it. But, you know, it's not like that. It's like, what do I do with this? Okay, you can give me any camera. Just give me a little manual. I'll figure it out. Okay, it's about what you do with that camera, you know? So.
Yeah, no, there's no question. And I think that in the olden days, back in the, when I was coming up in the 90s, 80s, early 2000s even, you could buy a film camera. And that film camera will hold you for a decade comfortably. Like you can, if you had an SR3,
yes.
If you had an SR3, SR2, SR3 just had a couple of bells and whistles. That's all it was. And this is for everyone listening. That's an Arri six, a super 16 millimeter camera. That's the one I did my film project in college with. I got the SR3, by the way, never saw an SR3 again in the field. It was only SR2s because it was so damn expensive to have an SR3, but you could hone that camera and it would hold. Nowadays, every week there's a new camera. Every week there's a new K. There's new technology constantly coming out. So it doesn't make sense for cinematographers to own their own gear unless they can turn it over pretty quickly, or it's a per project. Like this project's going to pay for this camera, something along those lines.
Or they rent out their gear as a side gig. But I mean, for independent filmmakers or students coming out of film school or whatever, I mean, there's so many really good prosumer cameras now that can make nice films with, and you know, a way that we never, there you go.
I'm holding up my iPhone 12 Max, whatever. I just, exactly. These lenses, I mean, look, it's not professional, but even if you had if you could just adapt it a little bit, put an adapter on it. I mean, Steven Soderbergh's doing some insane stuff with the iPhone. I mean, it's pretty remarkable. Again, it's not about the gear. It's about the person behind the lens.
Yes, yes. And in, you know, during the COVID times with teaching cinematography and stuff, I was doing it online, but they were still doing projects and we'd meet and screen them. But, you know, sometimes they were like, can I use my phone? I'm like, well, okay, let's see how it goes. You know, some had DSLRs and they could work with that. Yeah. You know, the difference is, though, you don't really have the lens variants that you have with a real camera, you know, which does make a difference. And you can buy, you know, a variety of $5,000 to $10,000 prosumer gear. That's pretty awesome.
Oh, you could buy a Blackmagic 6K for $2,500, get yourself a nice Sigma lens, an 18 to 35 photo lens. I've shot two features with that lens.
Yeah.
It's fine. It's prosumer. It's definitely not
you know, the high end glass of cinematography, you know, I've shot with Zeiss, I've shot with Cooks and things. And you feel the difference when you have like an Ingenue.
Oh, the difference when you start, I recently did a workshop for an MFA cinematography thesis project, and it was, we had Cook lenses on one crew, and we had, and the Cook guy came in to do the demo, and I was like, oh my God. I mean, it's just like Richard Crudo said to me many years ago, he goes, you shoot anamorphic, the camera could fall off the truck and you got a beautiful image. So that's so true, because I could see it. I could see it in the macro. The glass of the macro was unbelievable. I could see it in the anamorphic widescreen. It was just so beautiful. Even, and the Zeisses are beautiful too. So,
oh no. And
it's about the camera, it's about the lens.
Yeah. And that's the thing. If you're a director or cinematographer listening, the only thing you should invest in is glass, because glass doesn't go away. I mean, as long as it's a night, you know, glass is glass. The gear, the camera is going to change. It's changing as we speak. And all of that stuff. But the glass is where the investment lies, because you could, I love vintage. I love vintage glass. I love old glass that cuts down the, it cuts down the sharpness of like a red, you know, you get a nice 50, 60 year old piece of glass. What was the, not the, oh God, the one, the, oh God, the one that, oh, the, I can't remember, but it's a French glass set. And then there was an ASC cinematographer who pulled it out of obscurity, shot him.
You're talking about, but I can't remember.
Boulay, something. Baltars.
Baltars, yes.
The Baltars set, yes. The Super Baltars. I've shot with Super Baltars. Oh, on a red, stunning. And they're old, old glass. But anyway, we can start geeking out. We got to stop this. Let's actually talk about what we're, because this is what happens when I start talking lenses. I start geeking out a bit. But for the director and the cinematographer, how do you, how would you recommend that collaboration begin? How should a director, an ideal scenario between a director and a cinematographer?
Well, there's a lot of different ways that people come together, but from the 30 so interviews I've conducted over the years, the consistent theme seems to be you need to have somebody that you intuitively connect with, somebody who you feel comfortable with, somebody who you trust, understands your vision. You may have similar tastes. You may have a similar background. I'll use an example of Matthew Levitique, and he talked about working with Darren Aronofsky. And he said, we come from the same place. We like the same music. We like the same this. And so we could work together instantly. That's a shortcut that really makes a big difference. And when you really trust your DP, you like your DP, they're the person that, you know, you lean on when you start to flake out as a director and you're like all over the place. And wait a minute, look at your DP, and they'll be like, remember we talked about, oh yeah. You know, so it's somebody who shares your vision and doesn't contradict you, you know, especially in front of you. So it first comes with an intuitive meeting. It comes also for looking at each other's work and respecting each other. Again, using Maddie as a reference, he admires and respects the directors he's worked with. He really likes that sense of collaboration, and many DPs, Rodrigo as well, they like to share that vision, what they have, and feel like I have something that I can share with your vision and bring to this project to make it even better. You know, and that's really where it comes down to, just, you know, that meeting. You don't come in and geek out. That's the meeting you don't have with a director. You don't come in and say, oh, I got this camera and I got this lens and I got all this cool stuff. No. First of all, it's like, okay, well, what's your vision? How do you see your film? You know, what is the theme? You know, what does it look like in your mind? You know, because that color palette is part of the conversation. Mm-hmm. You know? And then the next step might be, okay, read the script. What do you feel about the script? And still it's thematic. You know, they talk about thematic things. Then, okay, let's talk about visual references. You bring me yours, I'll bring you mine. Let's see whether we're on the same page in terms of what this film looks like, feels like. You know, as a director, you can say, well, look at these three films. I'm thinking about something like this coffee table book or this particular artist. And the DP will say, oh, okay, I see where you're going. Also, hey, how about Van Golden photography? And how about this? And how about that? You know, and you start to share a vision. And that also would come in the discussion of color palette, depending on the genre of the film. And then from there, it's like, okay, we know where we're going now. And now the cinematographer will visually interpret the script, where the director will go ahead and focus on shots, angles, composition, framing, as well as working with their actors, you know, and that's really the coming together.
So, and I know a lot of directors, young directors, full of vigor, as I was when I was a younger man. I had all these illusions of shooting, you know, getting all my storyboards out, getting my shots down. And you do, and you do create that. But as I've gotten older and gone through this, leaning on the eye of a cinematographer, especially when you respect, I'm like, look, I'm thinking about shooting it this way. What do you think? And they're like, you know what? This would be a great one-er. Okay, how do we, okay, that's going to cut off about an hour and a half of setup times. Let's see how we can do that and how interesting it is. Leaning on that cinematographer, I found to be, especially one that I trust, is invaluable because I have ideas. And of course, I'm going to come in with shot ideas and because I'm a cinephile and he or she will as well. But I think a lot of times younger filmmakers feel that it's my way or the highway. And they block off that collaboration because it's ego or it's insecurity or, you know, their fear of like, you know, oh, he's going to take it away from me or she's going to take the movie away from me because you're running the camera. And there's so much of that stuff going on. Have you found that as well?
Well, I definitely advise against that. I mean, I've taught directing and I've taught cinematography and I taught cinematography for directors at UCLA Extension. And, you know, I definitely say it is best for a director not to be a tyrant and to open their mind, you know, to not say this is just mine, but to I'm open to collaboration. And the cinematographer and the production designer, those people, they're there to really serve your vision and to help pull it out of your head and put it on the screen. So to not use them as a resource is I think, really problematic for a director because they could make your film so much better.
No, without question. Now, one thing I always loved asking a cinematographer is how they want to break down the script. How should a director and a cinematographer sit down and break down a script, approach the script in general?
Well, there's different ways people like to work. I was fortunate enough to speak with Roger Deakins a few years ago. And, you know, he worked with the Coen brothers a lot, of course, mm-hmm. and, you know, they storyboard and sometimes he'll work with them and sometimes not, you know, it's not like you have to sit down with them. For him, he trusts in what they do, but he'll glance at what they have. Okay, I see what you want. He'll bring his perspective as well. Rodrigo Prieto talked about working with Ang Lee and he was a little bit more precise about the way he wanted things, what lens he wanted. Matty Lebatique loves to sit down and get in and work with, you know, I'll help storyboard or shot list or break down the script. Ellen Kouras, she'd like to just take the director, sequester them for a week and really pull out of their head what it is they want. So she's really clear on thematics and she definitely has a more theoretical perspective to it as well. So, you know, some people, they just, what a cinematographer wants is to be a collaborator. They want to be a collaborator. They don't want to be just a technician creating mm-hmm. an image. They want to help put their take into it as well. And so being pulled in the beginning is important.
Yeah, and I think a lot of times, the way I always like to collaborate with cinematographers is the shots and the ideas, we work it out together. We work the shot list out together. But the lighting is all them. You know, yes. It should be all them. And that's where this, you've said this word a few times already in our conversation, theme. Theme is extremely powerful because you look at a movie like The Last Emperor, which is just stunning, stunningly shot. Anything Deakins has ever shot. You start looking and you start seeing the theme through light, through composition to a certain extent, but there's definitely there. But the light and the lens choices are really what create the aesthetic of that theme. Is that your feeling as well?
That definitely helps to create it because, I mean, if your theme is isolation, you're going to use a different focal length than if it's somebody feeling really with all the people around them. So it's a difference between a wide angle and a normal lens. It's going to give you a different perspective and depth of field. If it's a person who is just, you know, falling in love, maybe we just want to see their eyes. Maybe you just want to see their face in the background. Doesn't matter. So, yes, lens definitely helps to underscore the theme. Color does as well. You know, whether it's muted, warm, saturated, desaturated, that's part of the tone that's being conveyed thematically and will tell volumes beyond the words and the exposition itself.
I mean, so, you look at a film like The Matrix, I mean, which is so the theme of the, of, I think it was Bill Pope who shot that. The theme of the Matrix lighting and color palette versus the real world color palette.
Oh, yeah.
It's so distinctive. You know, you got that vibrant kind of greenish because of the code vibe and aesthetics. And then in the real world is all just muted grays, dark. And then you're also collaborating with your wardrobe and your production designer. And that's another conversation, how you collaborate with all your heads to create the image, because it's not just the DP and the director.
Oh, never. No, it's the production designer creates the environment that the DP is photographing. So you kind of all have to be in concert in coming up with what the overall look is going to be. And the other thing too, is once that has been decided, the color palette and, you know, whether it's going to be saturated or desaturated, they're shooting that way intentionally. So you can't sort of, as a director, go and post and say, nah, I don't want to desaturate anymore. Let's pump up the color. It's really not, the whole design hasn't been created for that. So once you make the decision, you know, that you really want to go a certain way, you kind of have to stay with it and not change, because the DP has been shooting the film the whole way thinking what you discussed, and you can't all of a sudden change your mind at the end in you know, the DI.
And the one, and we'll talk about DI in a bit, but the one example of horrible example of that exact thing happening at probably one of the largest scales ever was the Justice League movie, where the one that was released originally by Joss Whedon was orange, that last battle. It was just horribly orange, and people were like, what's going on? And then when Zach finally got a chance to release his, you're like, oh, okay, this makes more sense, because that's the way it was originally shot. So they were like jamming something in that wasn't there. And that happens a lot, and especially in DI, because the power of DI is just, it's like Stan Lee says, with great power comes great responsibility. And
yes, it's true. It's true, because the whole thing can change.
Oh, it's, I mean, I was a colorist for 20 years. So I've colored 50, 60, 70 features plus thousands of other little projects. So I would be in a room with a DP and a director. And sometimes the DP would want to go one way. And when the DP would leave, then the director would be like, hey, let's go back this way again. That happens all the time. And as the colorist, you're like, who's paying my bills? I have to serve a master. I can't serve everybody. And so it's like this weird place to be. But you know, with a couple of strokes, you know, oh, the whole thing now has become desaturated, but the colors are so vibrant because the wardrobe is so vibrant. So now I got to go do more work to fight what you guys originally planned. And I try to explain this to directors. I'm like, look, this is not the way this was designed. I can do it. It's not going to look as good as if we just go with what was designed originally.
Yeah, well, that happened when DIs were first coming about in the early 2000s. That was problematic. And, so that's why it's kind of written in a lot of ASC and union contracts now that they come back to do the color correction so that it is their vision, the cinematography vision that actually is released. Unless, of course, the studio head and producer gets in and changes the whole thing. But that it's supposed to be in contract now that, you know, the color is the, what they decided on.
But at the end of the day, though, it is the director and or producer's final call, isn't it?
Well, it ultimately could be the studio's final call, you know, but it is the direction. The cinematographer is really the director of the images, the author of the images, right? And the director is the author of the performances. So, you know, it gets a little bit gray, but I think that the best collaborations, and if you want to keep working with your DP, I would say, you know, work together. Like, okay, we talked about desaturated. Remember? Okay, let's keep going with that. And how desaturated? Then we can negotiate.
Yeah, I mean, you're not going to go recolor Chivo or Deakins. I mean, that's just not, you know, that's not a conversation.
But you know, they do their own anyway. I mean, they want to be there. They want to be creating what they really intended the image to be. Right. So that's why they come back, and that's why they're now paid to come back and sit under the DI.
Yeah, because it's their responsibility. You're absolutely right. And we're also talking at a very high level. I mean, we're talking at the highest level of cinematography and filmmaking, as the names that we're throwing around. But when we're talking in the indie world, this is where it becomes a lot grayer. Egos start flaring up. You know, I've been in rooms where the DP got a little too fancy on set. And I had to save them because they're like, you know what? We're going to filter this. I'm like, we could do this without like hard filters. Don't get married to the image. But the DP wanted to show off for the director and the producer. I'm like, okay. And then when it came up, like, why is everything yellow? I'm like, ah. Like, it was literally just yellow. And I knew what they were trying to achieve. And I know the look they were trying to do an Amelie kind of vibe.
Oh, yeah.
But they put too strong of a hard yellow filter on it, a color gel. Not color gel, but yeah. And it just polluted all the images. And it took me, I mean, there's two big stars in the shot that we're talking about. And it took me, I don't know, 8 hours to kind of literally get in there and like window things out and follow. It took forever to get that scene done to literally save it. So, you know, that's a scary scenario to be in. Yes. And it was, and the DP just let things go. But when the producers got involved, they're like, wait a minute. That's not what we discussed. So there's that, and there's also the politics of it all.
Yeah.
Which was something that a lot of people don't talk about, is the politics of, you know, the DP, the director, the producer, then eventually maybe a distributor or a studio. But what's your experience? I mean, you've been in that DI suite a lot, I'm sure, over the course of your career, and have interviewed people who've been in it as well. What's your feeling as far as the politics are concerned?
Well, the indie world is very different.
Very. Very. So, of course.
So there's two separate issues here.
Completely different worlds.
You know, and I haven't been as high end as the people that I talk to. So their experiences sometimes are mixed as well. I mean, not everything has been, you know, hunky dory for them. And I'm talking about like major people, you know, in the ASC. Mm-hmm. But in the indie world, that's where I think the trust between a director and a cinematographer is even more important. Mm-hmm. And personally, I never would have slapped a yellow filter on without saying something to the director. But I don't think I would have even done it, because I know that it's better these days to color correct something like that in post. You don't need to do it. The only time I'd put a black and white, a yellow filter on, is if I was shooting black and white.
Of course.
And I really want to pick up the contrast. And then I would say, you know what? I'm going to kick up, you know, that's when I would do it.
But that makes sense. And we could do color tests. You know, like, it's not hard to do a quick camera test. It's a red camera. You own the camera. Let's go out and shoot something and let's test it out.
Yes.
It's not. Well, that was more ego than anything else, you know, and it is a problem. And of course, that DP never worked with that director again. And
I was just going to say never worked with that director again.
No, that director never worked with that DP again. And there's just so many, I mean, being in this suite for so many years, I just saw everything. I've seen the best of the scenarios, and I've seen the worst of the scenarios. I've seen a DP who shot a movie win an award at a major festival, and who wasn't even in the color suite with me. Okay. And it was just me and the director color timing the entire thing. And then they win the cinematography award, doesn't even mention us. Things like that. And you're like, you know, like, I know you shot it, man, but hey, a shout out to the director and to the DI, yeah. Because we are, you know, when I decided to DP my first film, I've been coloring for 20 years. So I was like, you know what? If I could just get this thing down the middle, I can save it. And that's exactly what it was. And I showed a few of my friends in the ASC about it, and I showed them the film. They're like, what do you think? They're like, one of my good friends in the ASC, he's a very Eastern European. He's like, my friend, stick to directing. But he goes, it's fine. There's an image there, but please leave us to the professionals. So I never, I didn't even call myself. I said lit by. I didn't even want to give myself a DP credit, because I just don't think of it. But I knew if I could just shoot it down the middle, and I did, and it shot raw.
Right.
Definitely shoot raw. Now, I wanted to ask you about lenses. Now, and I don't want to go down the rabbit hole on this, because we can spend 5 hours on just geeking. We already started. But what do you think directors need to understand in regards to the aesthetic of lenses? Like the basics of it, because we can go into the weeds about, you know, coatings and lens flares. And I mean, we could go on for hours about this stuff, because it's literally 100 years of different kinds of glass.
Okay, the thing about directors, not you necessarily, obviously, because you do have a more technical background, but there are directors, if you start talking like that, their eyes will just gloss over.
Yes.
And they will just check out. They just don't want to know, okay?
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now, back to the show.
Mm-hmm. So, but what directors should know? They should understand focal length and what that gives you in terms of depth of field. For sure, a wide angle is going to give you the whole environment and beyond. You know, a normal is going to reduce that. So, you know the basics and know what you're doing with that. Know that if you have a zoom on, that yes, you could do a rack and you could do that. You know, the vertigo shot,
the jaw shot. Yeah, yes.
Right?
Yeah.
You could do that and watch the depth of field come closing in. You know that if you're shooting a beauty shot close up, if you have a longer lens on, like an 85, that your background will be soft and your subject's going to look really good. But if you take a wide angle lens, you put it in your actor's face, it's going to distort. And maybe you want to do that because it's a horror film or they're psychotic or something, right? Mm-hmm. So if you understand the basic principles and also the basics of depth of field in terms of focus, because if you are having an 85 and you're in the low light and you're wide open, you have no movement in there, you know, and you can understand you're focused on the left eye or the right eye. And if they blink, it's out of focus. So, you know, I think that that's as far as a director needs to go, understanding the basics of depth of field, the basics of focal length, and difference between a high speed and a low speed. And maybe, you know, if you want to add a little more, what an anamorphic will give you versus a spherical lens.
And prime versus zoom. And
zoom.
Yeah, those basics, kind of things.
What I outlined in the chapter of the book. Mm-hmm. I don't go into coatings and all of that. And yeah, I named major company. I had a conversation just last week with the guy from Cook. Oh my God. We went way down a rabbit hole, but it was really, you know, but I wouldn't put that. I wouldn't put that in for a director to necessarily wrap their head around.
No, absolutely not. I mean, I'll geek out just a little bit cause I have to, but one of my favorite lenses is, the Canoptic. Are you familiar with the Canoptics?
Canoptics. No.
So a Canoptic is a French lens that, Kubrick shot. The end scene in Shining, in the inside the maze with the snow. He shot that scene with the Canoptic, which is a 9.8 wide non-fisheye. So it doesn't fisheye. If you remember the scene in Clockwork Orange when he's walking around the record shop, that's a Canoptic. It's all super wide, but it doesn't fisheye. That's the Canoptic. The shot right before the unfortunate scene in the beginning of Clockwork Orange, let's say, when they pan as the door rings, that's a Canoptic. So I love that lens. So I found its sister or the baby brother of it in 16, which is the 5.8 Canoptic, which you can attach to a Blackmagic 1080p pocket. So it has a super 16 lens and it's, one of my features. A lot of my shots were with that. It needs light. It works best outside. If you're inside, you need it. You really need it. You know, if you shoot it wide open, it's going to be soft on the edges. But you can pop in a little bit, especially if you shoot a little bit higher res. And I was blown away at how beautiful the image is. It's just, it's just wide and, oh, it's great. So that's and I got it off of eBay and they're available still. And the 9.8s are still rentable. They're rare, but they're rentable. But these are kind of little vintage things that you just like, oh, what did Kubrick shoot on? Oh, okay. There you go. Yeah, I want to shoot with that. So then I go down that rabbit hole. But vintage, I mean, look what Zack Snyder just did with Army of the Dead. That was all. What did he rehouse? He rehoused, is it still lenses or just old vintage glass?
I'm not sure. There's probably an article in American Cinematographer magazine about it.
Yeah. I mean, because he's working
with vintage glass, still camera lenses and rehousing them.
Yeah, he rehoused all his lenses and he shot, and you can tell like, yeah, it's a very, like there's barely any, like everything's out of focus. Like he moves 1 inch or two. It was a really unique for such a big budget visual effects film, pretty ballsy. And he shot the whole thing himself because he grew up as a cameraman, a director cameraman in the commercial world. So it was fascinating to watch, but that's what's happening now. And knowing something as simple as this idea, if you're shooting with a red, if you have a female actress or any actor, if you want to see the pores, shoot with new lenses. Yeah. If you want to soften things up a little bit, shoot with a little bit older. Zeiss, cook better because it's going to be a softer image.
Wolfers.
Huh?
I mean, old cooks, because
yeah, old cooks, yeah,
are getting sharper and crisper. Although they were saying the Zeiss is, you know, their lines are just perfect, so that from end to end the lens will be crisp and sharp, whereas Cook allows the fall off.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And so I think, you know, bringing it back to a director again, if you have the opportunity to test some glass with your DP,
yes,
and then put it together, and then, you know, you write like some notes. This is the 25 Cook, this is 25 Zeiss, this is this, this is that. Then you can really get a sense, and a director can respond to what they really like.
And if you can do that, and in today's world, you know, you probably could do that. I mean, you probably could have the DP like rent a couple packages for the day, go out and shoot some tests, come back to the DI suite and take a look at it and see what, even if you know nothing as a director about lenses, you could just go, I like the way that looks.
Like that, I don't like that. That's too sharp. That, you know, definitely.
Yeah.
And I mean, that's something that isn't hard to do. And it would be a nice bonding thing for a director. And
oh, yeah.
They don't know each other that well.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, then you can start to see where you're going. And I think more of those kind of testing experiences, watching films together, getting a sense of where this person's coming from, you know, understanding each other. That will make it so much easier on those 12 to 15 hour days.
Oh, especially on that 15th hour is where you really, you know, those last few hours of those days is when you start leaning on each other. And especially the director is leaning on the DP a lot. I've been on shoots where I'm just like, I'm either exhausted, flustered, I'm dealing with other things on set, and I can't even think of the next shot. And I'm like, where do we need to put the camera?
Yeah.
And the DP is there. Remember, we spoke about this. Why don't we shoot this here? Or the location changes, or we can't shoot at that location, so we have to run to another location and steal something. And we're like, okay, on the fly, what are we going to do? And that's when you want that, you know, brother or sister in arms on the day. And that relationship is so, so important.
It is. And it can make and break a film too, because if it isn't a good relationship and you're hating each other, and like I always used to say, don't fight in front of the children, like, you know, don't argue in front of the actors, because you're going to throw them off, you know. Mm-hmm. You know, go argue behind the trailer somewhere if you punch each other back there, but don't, you know, it can really ruin a film. So I think finding that person, and I think that's why directors who really like a certain DP will keep working with them. And, you know, and then unfortunately, if somebody passes away, it's harder to find another one to keep working with again. And, you know, but it's a shorthand that's so essential. And in doing these books, I was able to really focus on, the first one came out in 2009. So I was still talking about film stuff, you know, and that's when I decided I have to redo this completely and redo the whole thing from beginning to end. But so I got to talk to more people because of that, you know, and I really found that it was an important conversation, and that DPs feel very, very strong about it. They don't want to be dictated to. They don't want to be handed a shot list or a storyboard and say, it has to be just like this, because they say nothing looks like a storyboard.
No.
The lenses look exactly like storyboards.
Right.
You know, as a reference, cool. You know?
And then that's the other thing. It's like sometimes you work with DPs, with directors who are arguably could be lighting this themselves, like a Fincher or a Cameron. And I have a wonderful story with Russell Carpenter, who, you know, did Titanic, won the Oscar for Titanic, and he did True Lies as well and now he's doing Avatar with James, and his stories of James are hilarious because of, I won't tell it here, but I'll tell you off air, but I don't want to get into that, the whole story, but you know, when you have somebody like a director, like a James Cameron or a David Fincher, who arguably could light the damn thing themselves because they're that technically inclined, you need a special DP for that. You know, like Deakins is not going to work with Fincher. There's just no way. Just no way.
No.
No way. You know, but Chivo will work with Alejandro because that works perfectly fine. You know, or Terrence Malick and Chivo. We'll work together because
that's a lovely combination.
Oh, isn't it? Oh my God. Isn't it amazing? Oh my God. Chivo. Oh God. He's just like, you know, when you're with these kind of cinematographers, and that's the thing, when you have two titans, like if you have a Deakins and you have a Michael Mann, how does that, like, you know, how do you, how does that work? We're off subject now. Now we're just geeking out and playing around. But in seriousness, like when you have two titans like that, that are some of the best at what they do in their own fields, and they can't agree on the one image or the one way of looking at things, it must be hard. And that, and that's, those stories have been out there. I know Spielberg and these guys. Sure. Yeah.
You know, it, and that's also depending on if they continue to work with each other. If you look at a DP's credit, you see they worked 10 films with this one, one with somebody else, and then five more with the same people. That one was not a good experience.
generally speaking. Yeah. And then you could see, like, you know, Spielberg would work with, who was he work? I forgot who he was he working with, like, up until E.T., until, and then Janice came in, and then.
Davio Allen.
Yes, Davio. Davio. And he worked with him for a certain point, and then that was it. And he's Janos, and then Janos.
That's it.
It's been, he's basically shot everything, right? Since then?
Yes.
He's, because he's,
that's, it works.
And I go back to the well all the time with people I've worked with, because I just, like, I don't want to have to deal with a new relationship, especially at such a high level. Like, you want to just build that relationship, and okay, I know what I'm going to get with this, you know, as opposed to trying dating someone new. This is a relationship. It's like, I don't want to date someone new, and I have to pretend I'm somebody I'm not. And I can only hold that up for so long. You're like, it's like, I know you, we know each other. Let's just keep going down this road.
But like, you got Martin Scorsese, right? He worked with Michael Bauhaus for many years, mm-hmm. many years from, you know, they did like from that film After Hours in the 80s.
Sure.
All the way, then Michael Bauhaus passed. So he had to find somebody new. So he tested the waters, found Rodrigo Prieto, and now that's been working since. Mm-hmm. You know, he had Robert Richardson shoot a couple films for him, but it's been Prieto since. So it's like when you find somebody you're comfortable with working with, you go with it. You've got Robert Richardson. He used to work with Oliver Stone all the time.
Yeah, but then, and now he's Tarantino now.
Had a divorce, you know? And now he's with Tarantino because he found his new love, and, you know, they connected.
Oh, they connected in a big way. And, you know, I just wish Quentin would shoot more often so we could see their work together. But yeah, The Hateful Eight, I mean, stunning. And they're doing insane stuff, what they were doing and all that kind of stuff.
You know,
now you spoke about visual reference. What should a director bring as visual reference for their vision to a DP?
Well, it's anything from previous films, of course. Some, you know, you could say this film. I think Spike Lee would be notorious for actually screening films and then, you know, saying something like this, not, you know, knocking Maddie on the shoulder or whatever. If they don't have time, they would just share shot lists, streaming things, you know, check out this, check out that. So photography, of course, is a very strong reference. You know, you've got photography of William Eggleston for a certain time period, Dorothea Lange, Grapes of Wrath time period, Nan Golden, contemporary 70s. You've got a variety of photography. Sometimes it could be graphic novels, depending on the kind of, mm-hmm. you know, film it is. It could be old magazines, Life magazine, Look magazine for a certain vintage time period. Of course, there are a handful of painters that are filmic painters. You got Edward Hopper, you know, Caravaggio for chiaroscuro, Rembrandt for chiaroscuro, Vermeer for directional light. You've got Andrew Wyeth for a certain look of imagery. They're very filmic, and their paintings alone seem like stills from a film in a way.
You watch Barry Lyndon. Barry Lyndon, right? Yeah,
Barry Lyndon.
Oh my God! Like, those frames are literally paintings. They look.
George Latour, The Candlelight from Below.
I mean, it's literally like he just zooms out, and then you're just like still frame that looks identical to a masterwork. I mean, all, and it's shot after shot in that movie like that.
And I was pulling, and I was talking about, Sam Mendes talked about using Edward Hopper as a reference to Conrad Hall for Road to Perdition. Pulling frame grabs, I mean, there is a frame in Road to Perdition that looks like an Edward Hopper painting. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a scene where it's kind of split in half. The boy is sitting on the bed in a long shot. The Tom Hanks character comes in, but he's not there yet. So it's an empty frame. And it's so painterly. It's beautiful.
No, it's in Conrad. I mean, Bobby Fischer. I mean, everyone always goes back to Bobby Fischer and what he was doing in Bobby Fischer. All right, guys, I apologize. We're geeking out again. I knew this was going to happen. One thing I think directors should understand is the power of color and the color palette.
Absolutely.
Because color is so informative at a subconscious level. Green gives you this energy or feeling. Red gives you that. And I think one of the best uses of that was I'll use it again, Last Emperor. It's a masterclass in color palette. And what from like when the teacher comes on a green bike, you know, things, little things.
That's Vittorio. Vittorio has a whole philosophy on color. Yeah. But you don't have to get as in depth as that, except if you understand that that color, even just using color as complementary colors, if you understand the color theory a little bit,
the color wheel,
what's warm, what's cool, what's complementary, and integrating those. If something is the past, the period piece, it's warmer perhaps, and the present day maybe cooler. I mean, there's been so many films where they've touched on the color palette for specific reasons, saturated. Look what Todd Haynes and Ed Lockman do to recreate the 50s. It has this feeling of a Technicolor Kodachrome film, but it's not a film, but that's Ed lighting it like Kodachrome film, so the references will give you that to base yourself on, but you have to understand as a director, if you're saying, well, let's everything have a cool palette, what you're saying is this is a somber tone. You wouldn't use it for a rom-com. It's not going to work. Right. It's not going to play. Nor if you have a rom-com and it's all, if it's saturated and warm, okay, we want to see that. But if it's dark and chiaroscuro, that doesn't work as a rom-com either. So you have to understand your lighting and doing color for genre.
Yeah, and exactly. So you look at, that's why most comedies are shot essentially flat almost. It's just like, Dumb and Dumber, or the more slapstick it gets, the flatter it is. There's no in-depth lighting. Rom-coms have a little bit more shape to the light, but again, very specific. But then you look at, a Michael Bay film, and then, or a Tony Scott film, and the colors are vibrant and saturated in dark blacks because it's an action film. And then you look at Seven or Fight Club, a Fincher film, and the contrast is dark. And like you look at Seven, it's just, it's a masterclass in lighting.
But that's, because the whole look visually is a visual exposition of how sick and twisted and sad the story is.
Yeah.
It's telling the audience how to feel without telling them how to feel.
Right. You see a frame of Seven and you see a frame of Dumb and Dumber, and there's a different energy regardless of what's happening in the frame.
Absolutely.
And so understanding those basics as a director, you have a better, these are things that I think all directors need to understand at a rudimentary level to be able to be an effective storyteller in this medium. Basic color theory, basic lens choices, basic lighting. These kind of things are basics that you can't, I don't want to think about it. I don't want to think about, like, if you don't, as a director, you're relinquishing that power to someone else. You could take all the credit for Roger Deakins, or you could have a DP who has no understanding of what they're doing and make you look horrible. But you need to understand just the basics to go, oh, wait a minute, that's not what I want. That's not the tone I want. We need to switch that. Basic stuff. Do you agree?
Yes, absolutely. And it will, if you can get on the same page and really truly collaborate together, that's going to make the film so much better.
Mm-hmm. I mean, and again, Malick and Chivo, I mean, you watch Tree of Life and you're just like, you just sit there like,
oh, I love that film.
You just sit there and go, Jesus, look at this. When those two get together, it's like you're in a dream. It is really dreamlike in a way that I can't really explain it. And that's the beauty of it, is that the visuals of it are so dreamlike. And it's not that they just fog, you put some Vaseline on the lenses and nothing like that. It's
like a hyper-reality, ethereal quality.
Yeah. I mean, one of my favorite Kubrick films is Eyes Wide Shut. And I absolutely adore Eyes Wide Shut.
I can tell.
I love Eyes Wide Shut. But the thing is, with Eyes Wide Shut, it's a dream. it's a completely unrealistic thing in the way they did the sets and all that stuff. But the lighting, I mean, especially at the beginning, just the Christmas lights in the background.
Yeah.
And that's how they lit. They lit the whole damn scene with Christmas lights and I think a China ball.
Right. Which are good things to keep as a reference in your right. mind.
Yeah. I mean, China balls, the indie filmmaker's best friend is a China ball.
Yes.
cheap lighting.
Get a little, and they travel well. They flatten out. Just don't crush the bulbs. Keep them separate.
Exactly. Now, one thing with all the confusion of cameras and resolution, this is one area that, you know, it's a pet peeve of mine with the 8K, 12K, 6K, 5K, all this kind of stuff. So many directors get caught up in the Ks, like, oh, I'm shooting 8K. I'm like, good for you. It means nothing. I shot my last film 1080p.
Looks great.
Blew it up to 2K on a DCP, projected it at the Chinese theater, and I was shocked at how good it looked. I was scared. I'm like, this is not going to look good. And I was like, oh my God, it's one of the most beautiful things I've ever been a part of. So it doesn't, again, it's always about what's behind the lens, who's behind the lens and who's shooting the lens and who's shooting it. But what's your take on this whole 8K and the resolution wars, if you will, and directors getting caught up in that? And also then the power that gives the director with recomposition in post?
Well, in terms of, first of all, I want to say, there's a quote that John Seale said to me. He said, of course, with a really good Australian accent that I won't do right now, first 5 minutes into watching a film, they're not going to know. Your audience is going to not be aware of whether it's 8K, 2K, 5K. They're not going to think about that. They're going to be in the story if the story's any good. All right. So that, first of all, isn't going to make your film better shooting at 8K. And how are you projecting at 8K? Because you can shoot at 8K, but then it's being projected 2K at best.
And
if it's on a monitor, it's 1080. So what does it really matter? You know, if you are shooting something that is in the right now, 4K is kind of averaged out. You know, cinematographers had said that Super 35 is the equivalent of a 6K, 8K, anamorphic is beyond. You know, Super 65 millimeter is beyond. It's like 8 to 10K, whatever. But unless you're seeing it like that, you're not getting the impact of it. If you're watching it on your phone or on a computer, it really doesn't matter what you could be shot with your phone. Mm-hmm. You know, it doesn't matter. So to get hung up on that, I think is a really trivial and marketing kind of issue. That right now the manufacturers of the cameras keep saying, well, we can do this and this. How many Ks are we going to go? Do you really need to see somebody's pores? Okay, then you're a DI guy. You know, you go into post. Now you got to slap 100 filters on it to soften things up again. You know, you're putting green back that's now taken away from film, mm-hmm. you know, just to make it look.
The only thing I would say ever to shoot at the higher resolution is wildlife. Shoot it at 12K. You need that resolution. You're out in the savannah somewhere. You want to zoom in on a lion eating a gazelle. And you keep, then yes, absolutely shoot as many Ks as you can because you're more likely going to project that in an IMAX scenario or something like that. But the one thing that I've talked to so many DPs about, especially when I'm in the DI suite, was the repositioning. You're recomposing shots where the DP very, you know, with mission shot it and composed it one way, but the director comes in and goes, oh, well, let's get all our coverage from these shots and let's pop into an extreme close up. Let's pop out over here. Let's do this and that. Can you do that? Especially in an indie world, can you do that? Yes. If you shot 6K, could you get away with it? Yes. But the lighting is not correct. The lighting was lit for
a wider shot.
It's not lit for your eyes. Yes, you can jump into the eyes, but then it's my job then as a DI, and then I'm doing basically digital lighting and now I'm sculpting light in the DI, which takes longer, all this kind of stuff. So, but, and I know the DPs, every DP I ever talked to hated it.
Because every time you do a different setup, you're tweaking the light. And if it's a close-up now that's going to cut into the coverage, of course you're going to tweak the light, soften the light, do this. And so that actor looks the way you want them to look. So to just take a slice out of something else is not ideal at all. No.
And I mean, look, if you get in trouble maybe if you get in trouble, one shot, but not like, because we all do that. I mean, I've seen $200 million movies who shoot
it or whatever.
Yeah. I mean, I was talking to a DP who worked with Bay, and he literally was in the DI, went outside, shot a close up of a tire with his iPhone, brought it back in, inserted it, and made the movie.
Oh, that's awesome.
I mean, because it was like, yeah, I'll be right back. I'll be right back. Let me go get another shot. He shot some sort of tire or something with his iPhone. It was an insert. It was like a, you know, 15 frame insert, but he wanted that shot, edited it in. No one ever knew. Right. So it happens. It happens. But as a thing that is a constant is definitely not ideal.
But the thing is, like, you know, and resolution, things have shifted so radically quickly. Like John Bailey told me he shot a film a few years back. This was when DIs were early. They shot it anamorphically, mm-hmm. you know, so it was widescreen anamorphic. And they only did a 2K DI. So it was released 2K. Mm-hmm. So what was the point of shooting widescreen anamorphically? You know, there was no point. It was reduced. So, you know, if you shoot something 1K, 2K, 4K, you're great. If you have the opportunity to do something, or if it's a special effect thing, or if it is going to be IMAX or huge, okay, then the higher K's matter. But to have a little tiny camera and get hung up on, this is 15K, who gives a crap, really, at the end of the day? It doesn't matter, because you don't need to see that much detail.
Right.
You know, you want to.
No, you do not. Trust me. I've been in the DI suite, and I've like, oh, that actor did not. Oh, they didn't shave today. Okay. That's, I see every hair. Okay.
Look at that. You don't need to see it. I mean, remember with film, remember the music, the magical transformation that would take place. You're shooting on set. Okay. You got your Zeiss lenses and all, but you're shooting film. You see it transferred and it looks just beautiful because the eye sees different than film reads, you know? Mm-hmm. That's what made it so nice and soft and magical. Whereas you have a really harsh lighting and you have a really sharp lens in a 4 to 6K image quality, you don't really want that sharpness. It's too much.
And that's why Alexa hasn't really jumped up to 8K, 10K, because they're like, we don't need that. And arguably, Alexa has one of the softer images. I mean, when I say softer, I mean a pleasantly soft edges. And the red is sharp. As it's surgical, how the red sensor picks up the image. And I don't know about you, but I'm a big Blackmagic fan. I love Blackmagic cameras. I think they're the best bang for the buck for an independent film. And I've done tests where I've shot, and this is for everyone listening, because everyone thinks, oh, Alexa, Alexa, Alexa. If you can afford it, God bless you. God bless you. But if you can't, I've shot and I've spoken to ASC cinematographers who have Blackmagics on the set with as B or C cameras on Arri sets. And they're like, we can't publicize this because, you know, we can't do that because that's just, that's not the cool thing, I guess, or whatever. But they literally had, they shoot B-roll on it and you can't tell. And I actually said, like, you know, let's actually put this to the test. So I shot Blackmagic, Alexa, same lenses, same setup. Shot it down the middle. I mean, I throw it up there. I challenge anybody to tell me which is which. But where the Alexa starts showing its glory is where you start pulling it. You start going under or over, the Blackmagic falls apart. But the Alexa holds and holds and holds. Yeah. But if you're doing your job as a DP, you shouldn't really be under five slots.
I hope not, yeah.
I'm hoping not. But just for people listening, I mean, Blackmagic cameras are best bang for your buck without question. You can get a beautiful image. Have you shot with those or have you had any experience with those cameras?
Yeah, yeah. I have one right here.
Yeah, they're great. they're fantastic little cameras. They're fantastic cameras, especially the original 1080p, that Super 16 sensor. Oh,
the one I have.
Oh, so you're definitely going to look up that Canoptic. You got to look that Canoptic up. Look up that Canoptic. It's going to be.
I am.
And that speed booster. Isn't that speed booster amazing on that thing? You get an extra stop and a half.
Yes. Sweet.
It's.
I also have Canon gear. So I have, yeah. I have, you know, different things that.
Yeah.
It depends.
Depends on the budget, depends on the of the project, of course. One other thing I wanted to talk to, and we kind of touched upon this the entire time, but in a DI suite, how should a director work with a cinematographer in the DI suite, in your opinion? And I'll tell you mine because I've been in that suite so often, but I'd love to hear your point of view.
I think the DI suite really is the DP's domain, because it's their image that they're tweaking and polishing based on a discussion that's already been had with the director. So I don't think it's a time to do radical different things or to go off of that. I think that the DI suite is really for the DP to finish their film, to finish being the author of their image.
But where do you balance that with the vision of the director and the say, if it's a little bit different, and we're talking subtleties now, we're not talking like black and white to color or massive saturation differences or anything like that. But aesthetically, where I've been in the room where the director's like, I don't like that. But the DP's like, well, I want it this way. At a certain point, the DP has to like, look, if it's within 5 or 10% of where I originally had the idea, I disagree with you, but you're the director. It is your final vision. This is where that politics situation comes in. And then God forbid if the producer shows up, oh, forget it. You do not want the producer involved in this situation.
But, you know, then at the end of the day, I mean, you're working for the director. The director's not working for you. So if it was me in that situation, I would have to relent if the director really feels that it should be a little brighter than I intended it to be. You know, it is their film. I may be annoyed every time I see that shot, but isn't going to kill me.
Right. As long as it's within a percent, like if we're literally just, you know, adjusting pixels, it's a 5 or 10% difference. That's aesthetics. That's like my taste versus your taste. But if it's like 50% off, I'm like, no, wait a minute. This is not what we talked about. We went in shooting The Matrix, but now you want Amelie. Or you want Dumb and Dumber. This is not what we talked about.
Right. So that's it.
Now, can you tell people about your book and Cinematography for Directors, A Guide for the Creative Collaboration. Tell everybody about the book and why you wrote the book.
Yes. Well, the first book came out in 2009, and the second book came out in March of 2020, right on time of COVID.
Of course, obviously. For everyone to go out shooting in production. So great timing.
So the book, I haven't done any promotion for it. It's sort of like disappeared for a year. So I'm just pretending that it just came out now. So the second edition is new, completely updated. The reason I wrote the book is because it is sort of the thread between the director and cinematographer to kind of put them on the same page. It's written for directors more than cinematographers. But I've given it to cinematographers who've then given it to directors. Like, please
read this. Please, for God's sakes, read this.
Please read this book. So it gives them, it gives directors, producers, screenwriters, people who are not super tech savvy, it gives them an understanding of what a cinematographer does. Mm-hmm. And I use a variety of quotes from ASC members to kind of validate what I'm saying. So I talk about lenses, I talk about formats, I talk about visual references, color palette, working with the script. Formats, touch on color theory. I even talk about film versus digital, talk about certain types of cameras, where we are today, and a whole list of collaborators, directors, and cinematographers historically.
It is a book that every director should read, especially directors coming up who have not had the experience of being on set with many DPs. It is invaluable, because if you had a good collaborator as a DP, it's so hard to make a good movie, period.
Yes.
It's so difficult to tell a good story. It's so difficult to just produce a film and get it over the finish line. If you're fighting your DP, it's so much harder.
That's hard. You should be celebrating the fact that you're making the film, celebrating the fact that you finished the film, because you're going to be in festivals together. You know, you're going to be sharing it together, and hopefully you're both proud of what you've achieved. That's what, you know, and so I'm all about advocating for collaboration on all parts, for sure.
In life in general, we should all get together, have a Coke and a smile.
And if you do have disagreements, then, you know, just work them out calmly.
Well, you know what? And that's something that's very important to say. You will not all agree on things. And as a DP, I'm like, I want to go left. You want to go right. That's fine. As long as the DP understands that at the end of the day, the director is, you know, and I'm taking it as a director, I'm taking advice or input from the production designer, the costume designer, the actors, all this stuff. Oh, this location, that location, all these kind of things. But if you could at least respect. I think respect is the big word here. Is respect. If you respect your cinematographer and the cinematographer respects the director, you can work things out. As long as there's respect there, but you will get angry. There's no question you're going to get angry with each other because it's production. It's crazy. It's insane.
And you're creatives, and sometimes you're not going to see things exactly the same way.
Right.
But it's, I have to trust that if I'm shooting for a director, that it's their vision and they see it in their head. They know what they're doing. So I may see it this way, but they're like, no, I really want to, I don't need that. Okay. I'm not going to argue. You're done. Mm-hmm. Right. You have to have my shot. No. Okay. You see it this way. You know how you're cutting it together. Okay.
All right. And let's move it along. and that attitude is of an experienced cinematographer, because I've seen both the inexperienced cinematographer and the experienced cinematographer is just like the experienced director. So like, it's fine. Just move it along. I got to go get some coffee. Let's move it along.
It's really not worth fighting about.
It's pick your battles. Isn't that true? The young DP, the young directors, they fight all the battles all the time, and they're exhausted by the end of the shoot. Where it's like in every field, like what was that story? When there was a story of a young boy who wanted to finally fight his dad, like that coming of thing, like I'm gonna take you out, old man. And the dad's like, all right, you want to fight? Let's walk outside. And go. So the kid's like walks out the door. He's walking out the door to go fight him in the front yard. And dad clocks him in the back of the head and knocks him out. And when the kid wakes up, he's like, lesson number one, never turn your back on somebody. That's age.
Yeah.
I mean, that's abuse. But but you get the story. You get the idea. Yeah, let's hope it doesn't happen, but you get the idea.
What a DP, an experienced DP in particular, but even in, you want a director to be prepared.
Yes.
Don't come to that and go, oh, gee, where do we put the camera? Like, you should know that already. So if a director comes on set and they're prepared and they know what they're doing and they know what they want and they have a vision, that will make everybody's life so much better. It'll make the shoot so much smoother. Mm-hmm. And that's what you want to go for. You don't want to be completely unprepared of what you're doing.
Amen. Amen. Now I'm going to ask you a few questions to ask all my guests. What advice would you give a filmmaker trying to break into the business today?
Don't piss anybody off. No.
Well, that's obviously not possible, especially in today's world. You're going to piss somebody off by doing something.
Well, the thing is today, there is so many more open doors than there were before, mm-hmm. because you can make so many films digitally that look good. That you can submit to so many festivals. There's so many outlets now. If you're a woman and you'd like to be a DP, it's so much easier for you now with the doors being open for unions, for the ASC. There's an openness, and rather than, a discrimination against women shooting. So go for it, but do your best work and be strong and don't let anybody deter you on the path. And I say that for guys as well. You have to just be determined, follow what you want to do, and stay your course. I think eventually you'll make it.
What is the lesson that took you the longest to learn, whether in the film business or in life?
Oh, wow. That's a good question.
I appreciate it.
I mean, I think everything is an endless learning process. Don't ever assume you know everything. Remain open and be friendly and fun to work with. Don't take yourself so seriously.
I forgot who it was, but it was either a famous director or someone's like, the best advice I ever got to make it in this business is just don't be a dick. good.
But there's a dick still working in the business. So yeah. I don't know.
There is. And they do get to a certain place, but generally speaking, if you want to be on set for 15 hours a day with someone you get along with. And yes. if you're a prick, you're not going to work as much.
People aren't going to want to work with you, and you're not going to work with them. So, and that has happened, it's like, it's a hard job. And I've talked to DPs about this too, and they say they want to enjoy the experience. Life's too short not to.
Mm-hmm. And last question, three of your favorite films of all time.
Of all time, I'd have to put The Graduate in there for sure.
So
Apocalypse Now, because that's the one that made me fall in love with cinematography because of Vittorio. And the third one, That could be tough. I really love the work of Douglas Sirk and the cinematography of Russell Meddy. Mm-hmm. So if we go to look at like All That Heaven Allows or Written on the Wind, I love the saturation of the 1950s mm-hmm. cinematography. I love the work of Russell Meddy. Mm-hmm. So I guess I could say those.
Very good. And where can people buy the book?
They can buy the book through Michael Wiese Productions. They can buy it on Amazon, Barnes & Noble. It's pretty much everywhere now.
That's awesome. Jackie, thank you so much for being on the show. It's been a pleasure. I know we can geek out for at least another hour or two. but I do appreciate you writing the book and helping directors collaborate with cinematographers in a positive way. So I appreciate it.
Yes. Thank you so much for having me. And it's been a pleasure speaking with you.
I want to thank Jacqueline so much for coming on the show and dropping her knowledge bombs on the tribe today. Thank you so much, Jacqueline. If you want to get links to anything we spoke about in this episode, including how to get Jacqueline's book, Cinematography for Directors, head over to the show notes at indiefilmhustle.com/490. And if you haven't already, please head over to filmmakingpodcast.com, subscribe, and leave a good review for the show. It really helps us out a lot. Thank you so much for listening, guys. As always, keep that hustle going. Keep that dream alive. Stay safe out there, and I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to the Indie Film Hustle Podcast at IndieFilmHustle.com. That's IndieFilmHustle.com.